Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We're about to have a conversation with Rabbi Arik Ascherman, who is the leader of Rabbis for Human Rights in Israel, and is back here in the United States for a number of meetings and tours, and has agreed to come by our studios for a conversation. And Arik, welcome. Good to see you. It's lovely to see you once again.
It's great to be here again. Thanks.
So, Arik, for those of our listeners now who have not heard our previous conversations over the years, right, talk a bit about, first, about the Rabbis for Human Rights. What this organization is.
Rabbis for Human Rights is the only rabbinic organization in Israel explicitly dedicated to human rights, the only one in which rabbis from different streams of Judaism, Orthodox, Reform, Conservative, Reconstructionist, Renewal, all coexist in one organization without strangling each other.
Not always an easy task.
Brownie points just there for that. We are the recipients of the Speaker of the Knesset's prize for our contributions to Israeli society, to Israeli democracy. We're about 125 rabbis and rabbinic students, supported by many, many rabbis and many others around the world, who on principle are always involved in at least one issue dealing with the human rights of Jewish Israelis, and at least one issue dealing with the human rights of non-Jews who are part of our society or under our control. And so among the projects that we're working on today are education about Judaism and human rights. We work with the Army, kids taking off a year between high school and the Army, university students. We believe that economic justice is a right, and we deal with issues of poverty and unemployment among Israelis. We've been working more and more with issues of public housing, Bedouin rights inside Israel, and, of course, we're most famous or infamous for the work we do on behalf of Palestinian human rights, whether it be opposing administrative home demolitions, the issues that are going on in recent years in East Jerusalem, and perhaps our calling card is the fact that we send out people sometimes as human shields, literally, to protect Palestinian olive farmers from when there's settler violence. Not all settlers are violent, but certainly some are. Mm-hmm. And we have a legal team that has been winning back many, many acres of, or what we call dunam of land.
Dunam land?
Dunam. The measure of, there's four dunam in an acre. So a dunam of land is about a fourth of an acre. And our legal team has been returning to the Palestinian owners lands that they've either been taken over by settlers or the government, or where they've been forcibly prevented from living there, working there, doing their agricultural there.
So, and just to the point, I'm just interested. You, for our listeners, to be interested in that spectrum of rabbinic lives. You are what? Orthodox, conservative, reform?
I'm personally, my ordination is reform.
Reform's what I thought, right.
But as I said, our founders came from the different streams of Judaism, our members today, and with all the things that divide us, and there are things that divide us, there are issues we couldn't work on together. Ironically, it's easier to talk about Palestinian human rights than the status of women in Judaism or something, for example.
Right.
But these things unite us. Our common belief, starting this, what we read in the first verses of the book of Genesis, in the beginning of the Bible, that we're all created B'Tzelem Elokim, in God's image. And if you, as far as I'm concerned, with all the different divisions, and we Jews love to debate and argue about everything, the argument in the Jewish world today is between those who win all the things we have in the Jewish tradition about what we call Bein Adam L'Chaverot, the interpersonal commandments, how we treat our fellow human beings, they see as only how we treat our fellow Jews, maybe not even all Jews, maybe only our own insular community within the wider Jewish community. And those of us that when we read that verse in Genesis, that we're all created in God's image, it doesn't say just Jews, it doesn't say just the rich, it makes a point of saying both men and women.
So, and in Israel itself, you have this Rabbis Human Rights, this broad coalition of rabbis from across the spectrum, but it's really the state of Israel really only recognizes at this moment still the Orthodox chief rabbinates, the two chief rabbis, as the ones who make the decisions about how religious laws is to be carried out. Is that right?
The state gives the responsibility in terms of personal status issues. Marriage, burial, conversion to not fully anymore, but tries to keep those things in the purview of the Orthodox establishment. In other areas, such as there's been actually progress, the government doesn't prevent anymore from Reform or conservative Reconstructionist congregations to have buildings, to have congregational life. And so many of those things just go on kind of bypassing the government, I would say.
So what's been going on in Israel before you flew over here for your series of meetings on things you're doing in the United States before you go back? There's many areas I want to cover. Let's start first with what we talked to Dimi and Aziz about over the last couple of weeks, which are the demonstrations they took part in up and down Israel, where, what is it, 1 out of 6 Israelis were in the streets of Israel.
It is moving and perhaps unexpected. And there is a story going on today. The real story of all these protests is the issue of social solidarity. On the one hand, there is incredible social solidarity that just came out of nowhere almost, and we've also seen its limits. So what many people know and think of this as a student protest, a middle-class protest, and it really did start with one young woman who couldn't afford $1,000 rent in Tel Aviv for a shoebox, and as skyrocketing rents, said, "I want to do something." She pitched her tent in a fashionable boulevard in Tel Aviv, and the wonders of Facebook. All of a sudden, there were hundreds, and then thousands around the country. There is certainly much of it was being run by the student association. There's never, as long as I can ever remember. Mm-hmm. There's never been a student protest in Israel where students have cared about anybody other than themselves. And on the first day when a tent was being set up in Jerusalem, I went with, we've been working for a while with people in public housing or that can't even get into public housing, really at the bottom of the scale.
When we say that, who are Jewish, right?
Some are Arab,
and some are
but
Jewish.
Many are Jewish.
Because
yes.
People don't get me. I'm only digressing because I think this is important.
Yes.
Many people listening don't think about Jews in poverty, but a huge number of Israeli Jews, as well as Arabs, live in poverty, deep poverty.
Somewhere between a fifth and a quarter of all Israelis are living under the poverty line. Some 20%
official poverty line.
Right, and we all know that there's many more people. That's very accurate. Some 20% of the Israeli elderly are chronically hungry, choosing every day between medicine and food. Somewhere between a fifth and a quarter of Israeli children and youth go to bed hungry at least one night a week. It is true that one of the groups at the bottom of the bottom are Israeli Arabs, but also ultra-Orthodox, the Haredim, single parents, handicapped, new immigrants. There's many other groups that share that questionable pleasure. This protest, when it started, didn't seem to be about them. The first day that a tent was being set up in Jerusalem, an encampment, and I went with one of the leaders of a group that we were working with in one of the lower-income neighborhoods, and it was partly his own also baggage, but he came back and saying, "We can't be in a tent together, encampment with these people. They're just not where we're at. They don't want us there. Their issues are different issues."
Hmm.
And things changed. There was a lot of education that happened. There was negotiation, discussion. And that same evening, I said to some of the students, "Some of you are at least saying the right words, that you're also concerned not only about yourselves but about these other folks. The true test will come, your moment of reckoning will come when you're made an offer and it meets your needs but not everybody's. And does that mean that you're finished with the struggle?" And a couple of weeks later, our Prime Minister Netanyahu did make an offer that would have met some of the students' needs, and they said, "Well, we're not in it just for ourselves. It meets our needs, but not everybody's." And they, that was the moment I knew that something amazing was happening here. That really is what gives power to this movement. that it is it's left wing and right wing on Palestinian issues. It's different ethnic groups. It's different political parties. It's I mean people from different political parties. There's political parties officially aren't so involved. It's something very special and very powerful. And to have 450,000 Israelis in the street out of a population of 7.5 million, that's really something. But there are also limits. So it was obvious from the beginning that this movement would not deal with Palestinian issues because of the fact that you've got Likudnikim, you've got the Netanyahu supporters that are part of this, and that would have torn the movement apart. This is not something that they could agree on. But the unwritten chapter, the chapter that's still being written, let's say, is to what degree this social solidarity, this inclusiveness, is going to embrace Israeli Arabs. And this is a movement that speaks with different voices. In the Jesse Cohen neighborhood
In Tel Aviv.
In Tel Aviv, there was supposed to be a march from...
That's a poor neighborhood.
Poor neighborhood.
In Tel Aviv.
And it was going to go... People were going to come from one of the tent encampments to another, including one of the Israeli Arab encampments in Jaffa. And some Likud supporters in the Jesse Cohen neighborhood in that encampment nixed it. And a week later, other people from that same camp said, no, this isn't who we are. We want to be in solidarity also with Israeli Arabs.
You support Israeli Jews saying we want to be in solidarity with Palestinian Israelis, with Arab Israelis.
Right. And I've been at some meetings of people in public housing where we had all Orthodox and secular and Jews and Arab and Sephardim and Ashkenazim, Eastern Jews, African Jews, European
Arab Jews,
and all together. On the other hand, another issue that we're very involved with is the issue of the unrecognized villages. The villages, mostly Bedouin villages in the Negev, that are not on the map and therefore get no services, are always in threat of demolition as the government wants to move them to cities that have been created artificially and have been magnets for crime, poverty, drugs. There was supposed to be a government discussion, a cabinet discussion, the next day after this big march, the million-person march, and we thought there should be speakers about the fact that this plan to remove some 30,000 Bedouin from their homes was going to be discussed in the government the next day. Couldn't get it done. The people in charge of the speakers list didn't agree. Some speakers already on the list did mention this, but that's the chapter that hasn't been written yet. That's our job, of course, in Rabbis for Human Rights, and those of us who see that every human being is created in God's image. There are elements within this movement that want to include the issues of Israeli Arabs. The shadow committee that's been created to parallel to the Trachtenberg Committee, which was created by the government to deal with the demands, that shadow committee is absolutely dealing with the unrecognized villages. The people organizing the speakers were not. And we'll see how it's going to come out. It's the unwritten chapter.
And it's still going on. I mean, one of the reasons you almost delayed your trip to the United States from Israel was because of the people occupying a house or houses that you were part of.
The other thing that's happening right now is that as the students are mostly packing up their tents and going home now after 2 months, they're saying that they're going to continue to be involved in a different way. I hope that will be the case. I want to believe that's even if it doesn't happen, there's no doubt that for decades to come, social justice leaders in Israel are going to be people that began their journey, to develop their understanding of issues this summer. But whether they'll succeed in really continuing to keep the pressure on the government that exists today when they're no longer in the tent encampments, I don't know. But there are other people. Again, the people that we work from the lower-income neighborhoods, some of them literally don't have a home to go back to of any, or they're 1 foot out the door in danger of being evicted. Many of them, at one level, knew that this was a long-term struggle, that the solutions weren't going to come about overnight. And yet many of them, of course, had in their hearts the hope that this would lead to a personal solution, that they would have a home for themselves, for their children. as the students go to a new phase in one way, these people are asking themselves, what's going to happen with us now? Are we going to just be left out to dry? Are we going to have to just pack up also? And many of them are looking to bring this protest to another level. And so we've had a series of attempts to squat in buildings. Some of them have just been symbolic for a night or for a few hours. But in the Kiryat Yovel neighborhood of Jerusalem, we were part of the takeover of a building, a former student dormitory. There are one of the many, many buildings in Jerusalem and throughout the country that are empty, that have been abandoned, even as other people have no homes. And even as the government has been doing everything since the mid-90s to eliminate public housing. We have some 30 families in this home, in this building. The university, which owns this building, has now said they want to open it up again after it's been abandoned for 4 or 5 years for a student dormitory. And our folks have said, if they do that, that'll be a victory of sorts also. If they can give us a guarantee that that's what they're really going to do, then we'll leave. The day I was supposed to leave for this trip that I'm on was the deadline that the police had given for evicting people from the building, and it was hard for me to get on the plane.
So, and what Israeli police have done, though, is that what I've been reading, I don't know what happened in the building, but I know that they've been tearing down the 10 cities where people set up and destroying them, and people said we're going to build them back up again.
Right. So the national movement has kind of said, now is time to fold up the tents. But, again, that doesn't help those who don't have a home to go back to. So of the many, many encampments around the country, there are 11 or so which are primarily of public housing, low-income people who aren't ready to go anywhere yet. And even though as a movement the students have pretty much said we're ending this phase, some of them have said, for example, in Haifa, the students have said, we're not going anywhere as long as there's one person left in this encampment that doesn't have a place to go to. It's a moving thing that's happening. Some of the up until now, most of the mayors and municipal authorities have been fairly tolerant, even supportive of this movement, seeing that it was mostly directed against national government policies and not against them. But now they're starting to say enough is enough. And in Tel Aviv, there was, in many places now, closure orders have been given. The Association for Civil Rights in Israel is submitting a high court appeal to stop this as preventing the right to protest. We at the beginning actually did appeal with them in one city in Beit Shean where the city didn't want to let encampment be opened at all. But we don't know what's going to happen now, and things actually got rather raucous, I guess, in Tel Aviv, as many of these people that were now having their encampments closed down came and protested outside the municipal building, and I understand that a number were arrested.
So, as you said, there's no real connection to the entire movement that's been demonstrating Israel to the rights of Palestinians or of Arab Israelis, and most Arab Israelis I talk to seem to refer to themselves these days as Palestinian Israelis. That bridge has not been made. That's a bridge that you've been trying to build for years, and you put your body on the line for years to protect Palestinian villages from Israeli military. Right. But the majority of folks in this demonstration have not made that leap.
Right, and again, it's not even realistic to expect that leap in terms of Palestinians in the occupied territories. But regarding Israeli Arabs, or correctly, many people call themselves Israeli Palestinians, one could expect that. And it was disappointing to us when we saw that didn't happen in the case of the unrecognized villages, the issue with the Prower report and this discussion that was supposed to happen in the government cabinet meeting. That's our job now. We have to make sure that that does happen. There are elements that do want to see that happen. In one of the many ways that Israel is struggling for its soul today, we have decisions to make. Whether our solidarity ends when we get to the Jewish ethnic religious border or divide, or whether there's something that unites all of us as Israelis, whether we are Israeli Jews or Israeli Palestinians.
So there are a couple of things I want to kind of ask you about this time we have together. One is we are on the verge of what could be a – could change the – we don't know how it's going to work out, but could change the course of things between Israelis and Palestinians, between American Israel and in the world, I think, when the – because the Palestinians go to the United Nations and demand to be recognized as a state.
Right.
That's caused lots of consternation in the U.S. government and Israel. So tell me your thoughts on that, and tell me – September 20th will be the day where it begins.
Right.
At the U.N. in New York.
As a human rights organization, we have no official position on what the United Nations should do or shouldn't do. As an individual, I do have to say I find it rather ironic that one of the reasons this is happening now is because of a promise by the Quartet to the Palestinians that something, one way or another, they would have a state in 2011. And so the fact that the United States is planning on vetoing this is a little bit problematic in terms of just keeping to your word. But, of course, the bigger question in terms of what I do is what's going to happen on the ground as a result of what happens or doesn't happen in the United Nations. And the first thing I have to say is that anybody who thinks or pretends or claims that they know what's going to happen is deluding themselves and deluding others. Nobody really knows what's going to happen.
Right.
And there are so many factors and variables and possibilities of what might happen. I was meeting recently with Palestinian human rights organizations, and it was almost comic because we were each asking each other, hey, do you know what's going to happen? Do you know what's going to happen? Everyone's looking for some inside scoop. Nobody had it. All of this buildup could end up a mountain turning into a molehill. It could end with a whimper. There could be no vibrations, no repercussions. It just blows over. That is absolutely one possibility. And the other possibility is that we could find ourselves in the middle of a third intifada.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
2 years ago, in September of 2009, I was predicting a third intifada because I was seeing some of the same warning signs that led us to predict the second intifada a year and a half before it happened. And predicting isn't justifying, but the anger, the frustration in village after village. This time of year, we go around and meet people in the different villages in preparation for the olive harvest.
Palestinian villages.
Right. And there was an anger and a frustration reminiscent of the atmosphere before the second intifada. In East Jerusalem, that tension has just built and built and built and built, and it's so thick you can cut it with a knife. If I were to bet where a third intifada was most likely to start, I would bet East Jerusalem this time. Interestingly, in the West Bank, it's gone down a bit, the tension, not a lot, but a bit. Firstly, because the measures Israel took to remove checkpoints and roadblocks did improve the Palestinian economy. The second thing is that the Palestinian Prime Minister, Salam Fayyad, worked to channel that energy, that anger, towards state building. He basically said to his people, listen, we have this promise from the Quartet. Let's get ready. Just this last year, I forget whether it was the IMF or the World Bank, but one of them gave a kind of a said for the first time, the infrastructure is in place so that the economic infrastructure so the Palestinians could run a state. If Israel had just said, bye-bye, we're leaving, have your state, a couple years ago, things would have been chaos. Everything would have collapsed. Fayyad did a very good job of taking all that energy and frustration and channeling it into state building. And so now the question will be, what's going to happen if what happens in the United Nations sends the message to Palestinians that it's a lost cause, that nothing seriously is going to happen? What's going to happen to all that deferred anger and frustration? And that's why we are absolutely in the danger that we could be in a third intifada. The Palestinian Authority doesn't want it. That's, I think, when people are counting on the fact that because the Palestinian Authority doesn't want it, it won't happen. But the Palestinian Authority does not control the Palestinian street. Their credibility has risen a little bit in the last year or so. It used to be really subterranean. But it's not, or even the Palestinian human rights organizations. At the same meeting I mentioned, some of these folks said, you know, we organize a demonstration, but once it starts, we don't control what happens. It's the youth, and we can't control it, really. And there are, again, there are so many unpredictable factors that we just don't know what's going to happen. And because of that, it's anybody's guess what we're going to be looking at in a couple weeks.
So a couple questions about that, and one final thing, that the Palestinians are using this quote from Barack Obama. You know about this. Barack Obama spoke to the 2010 United Nations General Assembly. And this is his quote that the Palestinians are using, saying to say that the United States should be supporting us, and we're using this as our raison d'etre to go ahead. Barack Obama said at the UN, when we come back next year, we can have an agreement that can lead to a new member of the United Nations, an independent, sovereign state of Palestine, living in peace with Israel. So that piece of his speech has now been lifted out as a banner saying it's time.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's pretty much a common wisdom that Barack Obama and the current administration are not going to do anything significant before the next presidential election. And again, as an organization, we don't have a position on one or a two or a 10-state solution. But it is certainly disappointing that so many hopes and problematic from what we see on the ground, that so many hopes were raised and are potentially going to be dashed now.
So I wonder what you think the prospects are for a response among the Palestinians that you would see, let's say, in Ronit Tafni's film Budrus, about the Palestinian village that resisted nonviolently Hamas and the Palestinian Authority people coming together along with Palestinians and Israeli supporters to push back the wall, Palestinians to save their land, that could be magnified as a response to the quest for statehood at the UN as opposed to an intifada? Or is that just...
Some people have said the third intifada has already started, because if it used to be just Budrus and then Bil'in, where these nonviolent or almost nonviolent demonstrations, some of them, Bil'in as opposed to Budrus, did have more stone throwing and this kind of thing eventually. But now around Palestine, whether it be the demonstrations in Sheikh Jarrah and Silwan and Umm Salamuna and Nebi Saleh and all these different places, every week, Friday, Saturday, Sunday sometimes, you have these demonstrations going on, relatively nonviolent. I won't say they're entirely nonviolent. Some people have said that's already the third intifada that started in that sense. So that's an open book also. I think that many Palestinians today have seen and believe both in the justice and also the effectiveness of nonviolent protest. Whether there will be a third intifada, whether it will be stones like the first intifada, terror like the second intifada, or something different like Bilin and Budrus and all these places. It's a possibility, and we'll see.
If it was a nonviolent protest, it could, in a mass way, it could change the dynamic socially and politically in a way we've never seen before. It has that possibility.
I think that that kind of protest is the most threatening to Israel. I remember back in the 80s,
right.
Mubarak Awad being expelled from the country for leading a tax revolt and trying to introduce ideas from Gandhi and Martin Luther King into Palestinian protest. And that was very threatening because from the Israeli point of view, it makes things relatively simple to say, look, they're terrorists, they're violent, they're this, they're that. And as has happened in other places around the world, when people use these nonviolent tactics, it takes a huge weapon away from those that want to discredit them.
So when you in thinking about where things may go, I want to reflect on two other quick things before we leave each other. One is that when you think of the state of Israel, 1948, 2011, what you think this occupation does to the soul of Israel and to the soul of Jews in general? And I mean that, you know, it was just a few weeks ago, it really hit me when I was listening to talking to some Palestinians, and Palestinians using the word Jew, and the Jews are coming to take our land or whatever, the Jews. So I remember as a kid growing up with people in my family, in my living room, with numbers on their arms who survived the concentration camps, and of how we were raised in the community, and that when you heard the word the Jew, it was a word that meant somebody as a minority that other people hated, like racism and everything else, that you were at the bottom and you were fighting for your rights, and that was the Jew, right? Now you hear the word the Jew, and it becomes the name of the oppressor. So
there are so many difficult to fathom twists. On the one hand, we know that people who are beaten as children are more likely to beat others as adults. And yet, of all the painful things that I deal with, when I see, for example, Israel closing its border to African refugees, and I think about all the borders that were closed to us at our darkest times of need, when I think of Menachem Begin, for whom I certainly, between his ideas and mine, there is a huge gap. And yet the first act he did as becoming prime minister was bringing in Vietnamese boat people. He said, we who were turned away from so many ports can't watch people out in rickety boats in the middle of the ocean. And somehow we've lost part of that. When you talk about some of the damage that's happened perhaps to our souls, I think about the fact even some of the delegitimization and demonization being focused on Israeli human rights organizations today. It used to be that even among people that disagreed with us, the feeling I always had is people respected us. They understood that you need watchdog organizations in a democracy. They understood that we're also Israeli patriots who think what we're doing is in the best moral and physical survival interests of our country. And we see some of that eroding today. At the same time, my life would be easier if it weren't for four things. First of all, if I I often feel like I'm the man who knows too much. If I hadn't seen some of the things that I've seen, life would be much easier. Okay? Uh-huh. The second thing that would make my life easier was if I didn't feel responsible. We hear in the book of Deuteronomy, which we read in these weeks, time and time again we're told, Lo tuchal litalem, you can't remain indifferent. You can't turn away and pretend it's not important. You've got to be involved. My life would be easier if I didn't think that I could make a difference. It wouldn't matter, but everything in our Jewish tradition, especially at this time of year, the month of Elul leading up to the High Holy Days, where the message is people can change. Things can be different. And lo alecha melacha digmor, you're not responsible for changing everything, but you can't desist. You can't do from doing your part. And my life would be easier if I didn't still have faith in my fellow Israelis. If I just wanted to write them off and say they cannot change, they will not change. I used to play, believe it or not, I used to play football in high school.
Okay.
I was probably in the game maybe two or three plays in 4 years. I wasn't a very good football player. My football coach always used to say, I only scream and yell at the people that can become better, that can become good football players. I don't think he ever screamed at me. We, of course, scream and yell and shry a bit because we have faith that things in our fellow Israelis, that they can change. Otherwise, there would be no point. So between those who hide their head in the sand and just don't want to see what's going on, and those who say it's a terrible, racist, apartheid place, I want nothing to do with it, that pain that we're feeling, we let it push us forward to try to do some tikkun olam, to be God's partners in making this a better world. Maybe I'll tell you just one amazing story.
Mm-hmm. Please.
One of our most significant internal Israeli victories just over a year ago was when we defeated, as part of a coalition, but we had a major part in this, what was called the Israeli Wisconsin Plan, a welfare-to-work plan similar to what was done in the Clinton era in Wisconsin. In Wisconsin, almost everywhere else that's been tried around the world, studies have shown it increases poverty. It doesn't reduce poverty. We were coming up with a crucial vote, and we thought we were going to lose because these for-profit, private foreign companies that were running this program were pulling out all the stops and lobbying. We brought in a group, an empowerment group of women that we had that were in the program, Jewish and Arab, Palestinian Israelis. The woman who got up and argued most vehemently against this program, and we did win the vote in the end, was a member of Knesset from Avigdor Lieberman's racist
right-wing party,
Yisrael Beiteinu party, who used to talk about transferring Arabs out of the country, now only talks about loyalty oaths. to argue against it, she told word for word the personal story of an Israeli Arab woman from our empowerment group who she'd met just an hour before. Anybody had told me that this could happen, I would have said, what have you been smoking? I mean, it taught me something, that you never write anybody off. You never underestimate the power of the truth in our hearts to speak to the truth of other people, to the hearts of others. And that's what we have to do, whether it be Israeli economic justice issues, whether it be Palestinian human rights, whether it be the plight of the Bedouin, and we didn't have a chance to talk about the role that even the JNF, the Jewish National Fund, is now playing in foresting over some of these unrecognized villages, and our plea to the JNF, you do so many wonderful holy things. Don't sully yourself by being a part of this. And all these things, the common denominator, it starts with seeing that image of God in every human being, saying, we've got to look. We can't hide our head in the sand. We can't say we're not responsible. We can't say, well, people aren't going to change. And then rests on us the responsibility to do whatever we can to make that change happen.
Rabbi Arik Ashman, who is your title chairman? What's your title?
It's now I'm Special Projects and External Relations.
Special Projects and External Relations.
After 15 years as executive director.
Okay. For Rabbis for Human Rights in Israel. He's here in the States doing some work before he goes back home. This is our third or fourth conversation with Arik over the years. And it's been just a pleasure and honor to have you back in our studios.
Pleasure is all mine.
Thank you. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines, where you can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at UrbaniteBaltimore.com. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.